Now I can erase the note I have. O-L-E, 30 shekel. But you see, they're reliable. They sent the money to me. They kept their word. Kala kavod. Okay. What?
Remember to take a pen.
Ah. You almost checked that it's on. I turned it on, and this goes here, but he's not here. Yes, you're on? Okay. All right, today is January 28th, 2019. It's hard for me to think in terms. I remember 1918, but 1920. Yomo, I got good news. Since we spoke an hour ago, they're working it out. There's going to be a crowd coming from Odessa. So it's in process. So Baruch Hashem, I can face the world and we'll be using the money constructively. I want to say good morning to everyone in front of me and to all those listening. Hard to come down from Mount Sinai yesterday was... the Melamed Lahoil and all that we did and setting the stage for next Sunday with Napoleon Sanhedrin and Moriah Rebbe the Rav, and fascinating, but now we're in a different world. Unfortunately, I learned last night that while I was giving shir yesterday, there was a funeral, and I want to dedicate the shir in memory of this wonderful Yisha Gedolah, this great lady. The first class in the Kollel, which wasn't the class yet, it began in, some of you know that I got the building, I got this campus from Mr. Gruss in April of 76. And I write about it in Washington, sometimes I just shake when I think of it, but every syllable is true. How I got the, I just finished basic training, got the call from the Jewish agency, go to the King David Hotel, bring your book, we'll pay you for it. I was never paid for it, you should know. It's the greatest investment ever made in my life, but the Jewish agency owes me, I think it would cost $6, and so today it must be $29, burn on rev or whatever. And unknown to me, on Kolek's desk was already the contract to give this campus to David Jelen's Teachers College, and God privileged me to say the right things to Mr. Gruss, and we fell on each other, a little kid from the Bronx and a multi-billionaire, and we cried on each other's shoulders. You can read what I said in Washington. And we didn't have a formal program yet. A formal program, every year Mr. Gruss would come, check the building, and I would have lunch with him, and he asked me, well, do they have a program? I said, well, they participate in the second year of BMT's program. I was teaching, they came to my shir, if they wished, and he was upset with that. I want a formal program. So in 78, a formal program began. But in 76, five young men were sent here from America. One of them is sitting right in back. Then he didn't have all his titles. Today he's Rabbi, Doctor, Lieutenant, Colonel. You can't, you lose breath with all his titles. But then he was just Mark. And one of his classmates was someone who today is Rabbi Dr. Norman Amsel. Normie's mother-in-law, his wife, was also my student, Judy Weil. It's, if you recognize the name, the Marie Weil, it's a very prominent German Orthodox family. Hundreds and thousands of descendants. Max Weil's grandparents, I believe, had 12 children, like a clock. And each one went and expanded the family, and like 90% are still Shomrei Torah mitzvot until this day. And Jenny died. The funeral was yesterday morning. And she was an Isha Gedolah. There's a daughter married to Normie Amsel, Judy. And there's a son, Dr. Dan, also my student, Dr. Danny Weil. It's the Belzer Rebbe. I know, I don't know, I know that at a certain point, maybe even today, he was the Belzer Rebbe's personal physician. And she was an Isha Gedolah, again, running away from Hitler, the roots, the origins, from Belgium, ultimately to America. They built the Young Israel of Hillcrest. If you're familiar with that area, I believe Max Weil was the second president. The first president was Laufer, Avraham Laufa, Adolf Laufa, survivor, Hungarian survivor, if I have it right. Fran Laufa, I trust she's alive, should live and be well. Great people, Balet Stucker and Maxwell and Jenny, they were the next in line that put that shul on the map. How did they come in Aliyah? So I have to tell you a personal story. They had the misfortune, they were here many, many years ago, and they heard a guy named Rakefet spoke in the sukkah of the OU when it was still on Rehov Strauss. I have no idea why, what, when, where, what was that sukkah that I spoke. But, and they were visiting their children who had come in Aliyah. And I remember, I can't do the whole drasha now, but the heart of it was very simple. I raised this simple question, why the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim says that Sukkot is the Chag of Eretz Yisrael. You're familiar with that. We've discussed it in the past in a different context. My Talmud, Yossi Kloisner, Zichrono Levracha, differed with the Rav. Remember I told you the whole story, but I'll leave it for another time now. I told the story at the OU and I eulogized him too. But this was the old, old OU. And why is Sukkot Dafka the holiday of Eretz Yisrael? I said there's something very unique about it. Being in a sukkah. Generally, we do a mitzvah. Everyone sitting in this room outside of the young lady, also my students sitting here, I don't think Esther puts on tefillin in the morning, but we all put on tefillin. We put on tefillin. You know, you put it on your hand. Esther, you light Shabbos candles, you do it with your hands, right or wrong. We do mitzvah, but the only mitzvah that we really do, outside, there is mikvah, but I'll go into it. It's not for now. But a sukkah embellishes you, it surrounds you. When you're in Eretz Yisrael, I'm living here 50 years. There's another Rothkopf here, also Aleph Rothkopf. He lived here a few years, but today I'm much better off than him. He lives in Lakewood. No, you walk around in Lakewood, a Goyisha land, Goyisha air. I walk around here every minute, I'm enveloped by the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So this is the connection. Now, the Wiles were in the sukkah hearing this whole drasha, and they were very moved, and this gave them a push to come in Aliyah. So I want to dedicate today's shiur. She was an Isha Gadolah. She had a doctorate in linguistics. She was a native in French. I believe she knew German, English, Yiddish, a little Hebrew. You know, the longer you live here, the less Hebrew you know. That's a different story. But my wife, I always say about my wife, she's the only one I know that came in Aliyah knowing Hebrew perfectly, a Ramaz graduate 50 years later, up Gishvach, but Hebrew, what can I tell you? I made progress, but that's a different story. All right, going back in lectures, I just want to make one correction. We're going to hit him again today. We spoke about Jacob Schiff. And Jacob Schiff is an interesting figure, raised on the lap of Rav Zinzendorf Fol Hirsch, president of Temple Emanuel, and yet he remained a kui, a shatnas, a klayim. He washed before he ate, he benched, it was makpid that his kids should all come to his seder. He checked out all his children lit Hanukkah candles, and yet he was president of Temple Emanuel. But that was Jacob Schiff. But I made one mistake. I was looking Charlie in the eye and saying to him, remember the New York Post? Who published it? Dorothy Schiff. I said it was his daughter, it was his granddaughter. I just want to make that one correction. Now, I'm absolutely right that when it comes to Shanghai and that whole theory that the reason the Japanese didn't kill the Jews and were so good to the Jews that arrived in Japan, even though they were allies of the Germans, was that Mr. Schiff, he arranged the funding for the Russo-Japanese War. And he did it because he hated the Russians for allowing pogroms to take place against his brethren. And the amount of money he raised, the extended loans to the Empire of Japan in the amount of $200 million, equivalent to $4.3 billion in 2016. So to give you an idea, the biggest contribution ever made to an educational institution in America was just made by a Jew. It hurts to say this. $2.2 billion to Johns Hopkins by Blumberg, right or wrong. Halavai, he would have siphoned off 10%, 20%, and given it to yeshivat. So the money that he gave, it's less than half of what Jacob Schiff raised for the Japanese. So that theory holds weight, that he went out of his way to help and went out of his way, they went out of their way later to repay him, because the leading people in Japan felt the Jews are good, others felt they have money, control banks, but halacha lemaisa, Mir Yeshiva survived in toto. If you didn't die from illness, which couldn't be avoided, you survived. You were never persecuted. Okay, now let's come back here and let's pick up where we left off. It's a fascinating, we're going into a fascinating world now. You know what you're in. You're in the Achvei 7th, 8th year, I have no idea, of the history of Torah in the United States. And we're rolling. So we finished out the Agudas HaRabbanim, we finished out the Blazer Silva. There's no question what we spoke about last week lends itself to criticism. Can you control the Jewish center on Shabbos? They shouldn't bring out their towels. In other words, they're allowed to swim, but you're going to provide plastic, polyethnic bags, plastic bags, so let them take it home, don't drink it out on Shabbat. It's an impossible situation. Reb Lezer had some control in Cincinnati, so and I list out all the regulations he put into the so-called hetter, if you want to call it, the permission to open on Shabbos. They were probably open anyway, but he was caught in the quagmire. In modern times, you can't do anything. As I speak now, I have to be aware that thousands are listening. Every word you say. Now, I'm not telling any secrets. I just want to be careful not to embarrass anyone. But you can imagine the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Israel, everything is overheard and it goes online and there's no control over what you can put into the computer. You have to be very, very careful. In the 1960s already, National Jewish Post and Opinion, what happened in Cincinnati, already without the computer, without the mechanisms we have today, it was national news. Within a week, it was headlines in every local Jewish paper. So it became a cause célèbre. Ultimately, Rabbi Silva backed down. But this is indicative of what we're up against in a democracy, in a Western world, where the attitude is, and even in the state of Israel, from Jews, you'll take a lesser stern, today, bedimus. It's interesting, they use a Greek word in modern Hebrew, bedimus. It means, so how would you, retired. He's a major general in the IDF, or what they call a lieutenant general. I never, you know, my English, a tataluf is, what's the word they use? A tataluf in English. See, an aluf is a lieutenant general, but there's only one major general, it's the chief of staff. A tataluf is a brigadier general, okay? To my way of thinking, I would call a tataluf a lieutenant and the aluf a major general, and the one chief of staff, call him chief of staff. But okay, so Elazar Stern, who's a frum guy and a Tiv Meir graduate, he lives next door to a student of mine in Hoshaya, and his concept of Judaism is very simple. Democracy wins out. I'm frum, don't force your neighbor. Why can't you have a bus on Shabbos? I'm not telling you to drive it. I'm not telling you to ride on it. But why can't they? They want a bus, let them have a bus. You don't want to swim in Shabbos, so what? But why should I force someone else not to swim? And this is what we're up against in the modern world, because the Western world's concept is live and let live. The Western world's concept is freedom of choice. What we said yesterday, New York, I'm still shaking. I hate to say it, but I think the world, is that part of the world, will be wiped out. God is going to get furious. It's not enough. Men marry men, women marry women. Now the state is allowing abortions up to the time the baby is born. You have any idea what that means? You ever see an embryo at the? I just had a great grandchild born early. Remember, I told you my granddaughter in law was Bishmirat Hareyon. The government of Israel spent a fortune. She was in the hospital like for 2 months. The baby was born at the end, at like the start of the 8th month. And the baby is fine. Kanai and Hara, absolutely perfect. Yeah, very small at first. Now, Baruch Hashem, gaining weight, everything fine. And you're going to abort a child 7-8 months in the uterus? And Como is rejoicing. He wants the building lit up, the trade center to rejoice. And this is a Catholic? This is a Roman Catholic? Guts a lot hidden where we're at. Where's the church? They have no power today. No, they're speaking out against them. No, melech sechais. They're laughing. Who believes today? You understand? Go to France. Go to England. When did the president of the United States, who as a Jew, as an Israeli, I love him. I named him first. Cyrus II, the New York Times, owes me a copyright. But when did he last go to church on Sunday? Did anyone see him recently in church? All right, let him accompany his daughter to shul. I'd be happy to see that too. Let him accompany his daughter to shul. But all right, this is a real problem. I don't want to minimize it. Reb Lazer got caught in it. And the family, off the record, you know, I'm very close to the greater Silver family as a result of my research and their help in giving me his archives, etc., etc. I want to tell you, they were embarrassed, you know. It's sad. But this is America. These are the pressures. And that was in the latter part of his life. With his death, ultimately, it's the end of the Agudas HaRabbanim as an organization of practicing rabbis, mainly Rashi Yeshiva. And as they ended off, ultimately what remains is the property on the Lower East Side of New York, caught up in legal, if you follow what goes on, it's worth a fortune today, regentrification. What 50 years ago, 40 years ago, no one wanted to buy. Today it's worth millions. Who gets the money, etc.? Okay. Then we want to come into the RCA. In order to talk about the Rabbinical Council of America, we have to talk about a world that changes, a world that shifts. And I have to be honest with you, this is the great challenge to a Rebbe. Some of you know I'm teaching Torah 60 years. I'm still very, very close. I just spoke to a student of mine. Yomo is in my office. He knows I spoke to a student out of the 60s. We go back. He's older than I am today. Now, and you know, there's stories I can, it's not for now, but when my new book comes out, I'll talk about a certain personality who I'm bringing back to life. And a Rebbe, whoever heard of a Rebbe teaching 60 years? In order to teach 60 years, you have to reinvent yourself every 20 years, or even less, maybe every 10, 15 years. The truth of the matter is, it's an open Gemara, it appears twice in Shas, in Vaikatan and Chagiga. You know, it's based upon a pasuk in Malachi, if the Rav is like an angel, learn Torah from him. If he's not, Lamad Torah mipiv. If him lo, no. Now, what does it mean if the Rav is like an angel? I'm an angel. I'm a human being. We're all human beings. I was very close to the Rav, and I guess we remember the Rav saying, Chavdish kan ruach ha-kaydish. Chavdish kan ruach ha-kaydish. And this was the Rav, and we were sitting there, you know, with the chilu rechimu, you know, we all made the kal v'chomer. If the Rav doesn't have ruach ha-kaydish, who the heck are we? So, what does it mean you're like a malach? That's very simple. Time does not affect the malach. This is my take. I have a lot more to say, but I just need this piece for today. If we're a human being, you have Shiashirim, Mishlei, Kohelet. Three periods in life. If you look into the Midrash Rabbah, you'll see there's a whole machlokes. What order did Shlomo HaMelech write these Svarim? But the accepted vision is the obvious one. Shiashirim in his youth, Mishlei middle age, Kohelet old age. No, if a Rebbe would go through three periods, and there are Rebbeim, I don't want to mention a name, a very prominent Rosh Hashiva in New York. I live on a street named in his memory. I just wrote a Haskama to a book that's coming out shortly, Chabad and Rav Yitzchak Chutna, okay, Chabad and Chaim Berlin. So I write in my Haskama, who is the real Rabbi Chutna? Is it the Talmud of Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, or the devotee of the Satmar Rav? I wrote a little bit more. The author of the book wrote back to me, oh, that was an insightful haskama. He liked Baruch Hashem, he liked the haskama. All right, I read the book. Most people write haskamas, they don't read the book. I read the book, I made corrections, he corrected. I gave haskama. Not that I agree with all his conclusions, but the book is interesting, fascinating. Chaim Dolfin, if you recognize the name, is the author. So, all right, if a Rebbe goes through periods, I also mention in my haskama that the book brought me back to my youth. Vic, how did the book bring me back to my youth? Two of the people he talks about in the book, I'll mention the names, Rabbi Yehoshua Fishman and Rabbi Elkanah Schwartz. Make believe you recognize the name, so they even pass for the wise, but Elkanah Schwartz you should recognize, Nishvait from Borough Park. These are my friends in Bnei Akiva. See, I mentioned it. I want to see if they protest. I, Chas v'Chalila, don't reveal Jazid Torah Mesorah. All right, Baruch Hashem. So, no. To be an outstanding Rebbe, you cannot have three different periods. Otherwise, in your youth, you raise Mizrachiites, in your middle age, you raise Agudistim, and in your old age, you raise Naturah Katoliks. You follow me, Dov? That's not healthy. That's not good. A Rebbe has to be all three periods together. And that's a malach. The Rav is like a malach, lemat Torah bipiv. All right. Now, why is this so important? It's very simple. When we start talking about Rabbinical Council of America, you have to have a world that is ready, that can accept them, that can understand them. The Agudas HaRabbanim functioned in a period where they were transplanting East Europe in America. Think for a moment, those of you here who have parents who are immigrants, they still lived with dual culture. My grandparents came to America, my wife's great-great-grandparents already came to America. Well, they lived, my grandparents, the East Side, her great-grandparents, East New York. A shtibel, it was still, they felt Europe, they were part of that world. Their children already start Americanizing. And you have to have a world that's shifting gears. In other words, the old Agudat HaRabbanim people couldn't really succeed in the new world. They were still in their concepts. The RCA ultimately builds up because America is shifting. It's a new world. It's a new period. It's a new Mishle, a new Kohelet. Call it whatever you wish. The times have changed. And there's a need for Rabbanim who can speak the language of the people today. Wait a minute. Did we rob these shirts together? I bought this in Kibbutz Sha'ul. Where did you get your shirt?
I think my mother-in-law gave it to me.
Where does she live?
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. She sat in the Arachachu, your shirt, my shirt. You didn't have to go to Brooklyn. I take you to Kibbutz Sha'ul. 10 minutes from here. 5 minutes to get it. Okay. So you see the world shifted. Now, who do we start talking about last week? So I told you the four... First of all, we made the point, remember my point, it's a good point, a witticism, that the three rabbis who created the American rabbinate, the modern rabbinate, the YU rabbinate, the Young Israel rabbinate, the RCA rabbinate, call it what you wish, the OU rabbinate, the three rabbis were Goldstein, Young, and Lookstein. And I made the point, remember I gave you the source in Tumat HaMissa, it was like the three great Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Rabbi Young, you would call the Chacham, called the Lamdin, that like Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza. Rabbi Lookstein was the Chacham, like Rabbi Simchel Zaziv, and who are we leaving out? Rabbi Lookstein, right? Rabbi Young, Rabbi Goldstein, and Rabbi Goldstein, excuse me, Rabbinus Goldstein was the Tzaddik. He already was the Frumma. Like who do we compare him to? Naftali Amsterdam. These were the three terms that he was. And these three Rabbanim created the American rabbinate. But we have to create a different world, a world that's willing to accept such rabbis. And there was one forerunner who basically is forgotten. And I started speaking about him last week, and I want to finish off today, and then we're going to create a new world, which ultimately is willing and needs rabbis such as Goldstein, Young, and Luchstein. Now, I'm talking about Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman. I gave you the years last week, 1861, 1945, and his story is worthy of a movie. Halavai, people, here's a man who grows up in America, German origins, grows up in a home of Chilul Shabbos, Jersey City, and goes to Sunday school in Temple Emmanuel in New York, attends what we would call today their Hebrew school. At those times, they called it a Talmud Torah. And this kid has an interest in religion. And they notice that he has an interest. And they say to this kid, look, we want to send you to Germany. We want to educate you. We want you to become a rabbi. There were no rabbinical schools in America at the time. And when you come back, you're going to be the rabbi, ultimately the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel. And they send him to Breslau, which wasn't reform. It was more what we would call today historic school or Borough Park, not Borough Park, excuse me, historic school or conservative, I would say, closer to Solomon Schechter, a lot closer than to Mordechai Kaplan. And he goes to Germany, and what I didn't tell you last week, I don't think I told you, but this also was in his memoir. It was published at the end of his life, a very fascinating volume. One second, I gave you the name last week. Let me just see if the Unfailing Light was published by the Rabbinical Council of America in 1948. So it was right after he died already. And it's a very fascinating memoir where he's very brutal. You couldn't write when my work Washington came out. So one of the nicest compliments I got was, Rebbe, it's unbelievable. You wrote over 500 pages without one negative word. I said, yes, I went out of my way because God has led me on a good path. I don't want to be like everyone else and say I'm right, everyone else is wrong. We all have a point of view, but we have to be positive. His memoir is interesting because he relates certain gossip that we wouldn't relate today. You'll see later in a moment, I'll quote. And how did he become so frum? So while he was in Breslau, he decided to tour. You know, you're in Europe. When there were no classes, he decided to go to Poland. So he goes to Poland, he stays in a little Jewish hotel, and he describes, it's a normal Wednesday, a weekday, and they eat, they wash, they make a motzi, and Chassidish Yidden are sitting near him, and I'm quoting him now, that they benched with more kavana than we bench on Erev Yom Kippur at the Suda Mapseket. Okay? And he was overwhelmed. He saw real Jews. And this moved him. And when he came back, he already was a Shomer Torah mitzvah. He marries the right girl. Again, if we're talking about the Wild family, he marries the daughter. It's Jonas Weil. It has to be relative to the lady who just died, her husband, Max and Jenny Weil. He marries Jonas Wall's daughter, prominent German businessman, 100% frum, and the father had just organized congregation Zichron Ephraim, and he becomes the rabbi. He remains there until the end of his life. Today you know that shul, that's a very well-known shul. The name has changed from Zichron Ephraim to Park East Synagogue. Park Avenue, someone lives on Park Avenue, is not going to denigrate that fact. He's going to boast, my address, Park Avenue. And he remained there all his life. It's a compliment to him, very highly thought of in the rabbinate. I was a kid when he was still alive, but even following his death, I knew the other rabbis there. Everyone spoke of him with awe. Now, he teaches at the seminary, and as I told you, by 1909, 1908, He leaves the seminary, pardon that slip of the tongue, 1909. He leaves the seminary and he comes to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan. And I explained to you last week why and what was happening in the seminary, and it was obvious. There was no place for him. They were happy to see him leave. He was too firm, too strong, didn't compromise, and things were changing. Although, I have to say, 1909, it still was a religious place, still Alpi Torah mitzvah, but the winds of change were already in the air. And if you read Solomon Schechter's writings, you'll see that the best way to describe Solomon Schechter is that he was orthoprax, but not orthodox. His concept, the Torah Shabbat Peh, is not our concept. And you can read his writings. There's collected writings, volume 1, volume 2. I think there was a third volume. His essays, he had Americanized, and he understood America. At one of the graduations, he said that if a rabbi in America doesn't understand baseball, doesn't know baseball, he can't be a rabbi. So that shows you he Americanized. I mean, the Rav had to learn baseball. He was also in America. This is a reality. Fine. But he also allowed the pressures. In other words, you take the whole women's issue, an issue which has haunted us for more than 100 years now. But the women were saying, we go to high school, we go to normal college, that was teacher's training, that's where women went, and the women didn't yet go to colleges, they didn't yet become lawyers, doctors, but they were getting the right to vote, right or wrong, the suffragettes. And the women said, plain and simple, why should we sit behind the wall in the synagogue? And if you know, look into the Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, you will not find one mention of a machitza being required for a shul. The reason is very simple, that separation of men and women was axiomatic to Judaism. Open up the Chumash, what you read in Parshat B'Shalach, Az Yashir Moshe, Uvenei Yisrael, and right afterwards Miriam goes with the women, B'tupim U'mucholot. So it was so basic, it's like in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't tell you how to breathe there. But, he gave in ultimately on the machitza, and that was the start of the end. It's a process that began slowly, but who would ever dream to lahatir, driving to shul, driving to temple on Shabbat? That already is the early 50s, and I need not tell you, from the 50s until today, there's nothing left. There's no difference, basically, between JTS, in theory, than a Hebrew Union College. So, you know, the question always comes up, why do you need a conservative movement? Well, people are voting on with their feet. They talk it only the conservative movement. They've gone down tremendously in numbers. But the answer is very simple. When you have a building, a structure, a whole faculty, a library, you don't give up so easily. There's an inner momentum that keeps everything going. Now, he got very involved in the Union of Orthodox Congregations, and he is the second president. The first president of the Union of Orthodox Congregations, if you remember, I told you this a year or two, 3 years ago, was Rabbi Dr. David the Solapool. This was before the Solapool. This was Dr. Mendes. This is the rabbi of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue before the Solar Pool. And the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, you have to understand, this is a tradition that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. They never had a problem of mechitza. They always had a balcony. They always had men and women separate. It's part of their culture, part of their tradition. It has nothing to do with personal frumkeit. You could have had in the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue at a certain period, 90% of the members were Mechallelei Shabbos. Today it's different. Today everything is different on that level. But the shul, this is the Spanish-Portuguese tradition. So they never had these problems. And their rabbis, Pereira Mendes, later succeeded by the Solar Pool, their rabbis were totally American, born in America, raised in America, integrated into America. I remember growing up, the top-seeded tennis player in the United States, number one, was Vic Seixas, S-C-X-I-A-S. And he was as WASP as you could be. But he knew that seven generations back, his great-great-great-great-grandfather was the first rabbi in America. Was Reverend Seishi, Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. So see, they were totally integrated into America. So when you organize the OU, which is the first attempt really to bridge America and Torah, many of the organizers were Spanish-Portuguese, German, and East Europeans who had a culture, who already were part of the American scene. Remember, they had debates what language to use at their public meetings, Yiddish or English, but ultimately English went out before 1900. It's organized 1898, so it shows you where they were at. When Pereira Mendes was on in years, Rabbi Bernard Drachman took over. Now, he deserves a lot of credit on a different level. The OU, under Rabbi Bernard Drachman, organized a Sabbath Alliance division, and it's called the Jewish Sabbath Association. Later, this was followed by Young Israel. I still remember as a kid, Young Israel, the 1940s into the 50s. Later, this becomes an independent association. It's no longer part of the OU. What are we talking about? A Sabbath Association. People wanted to be Shomer Shabbos. Time and again, you hear the memoirs. If you don't come in Saturday, don't come in Monday. Right? Memoir literature filled with it. This association, the first one, by the way, set a certain standard. Employers who were Shomer Shabbos would look for people who applied to the association because they wanted to work for people that is Shomer Shabbos. In other words, it was like a shidduch institution. Today, the OU, the Young Israel, no one has to engage in this anymore because Baruch Hashem in the United States, you don't work on Saturday, you don't work Sunday. The big change came about in the late 50s, early 60s. So you don't need this today. Baruch Hashem, in the state of Israel, you know, we have a law that was passed by the last Knesset. You know what happened? They opened up. I spoke about this yesterday, Sirona. Remember I spoke yesterday about Sirona? So in the shopping mall at Sitkiyahu, those of you who have gone to Machne Yehuda know that the best pickles, the best quiches, they have various stores. It's a Yerushalmi family. So they fabulous food. Svadim, Eidot HaMizrach. So they opened up a branch in Sirona and they refused to open on Shabbos. So the people who run the mall wanted to sue them. I think it was 25,000 shekel a Shabbos if they're not open because they get a percentage and the main day of the week, Lo Aleinu, is Shabbos. And they refused. It became a cause célèbre here. So the Knesset passed the law, this Knesset now, that you cannot force a Jew to work on Shabbos, and you cannot fire him. There, if you'd fire a Jew, well, you have to pay him a million shekel or something. So you see, you're protected in Israel. Even this type of concept protects Jews. God have mercy that we have to come to it. But this is the reality. In the Western world, no one works Saturday, Sunday. But then it was a shit. Today, we need shidduchim to make marriages. Today I have a different problem. We have tens and tens and hundreds and thousands and thousands. Last night people were crying to me, the daughter is here, the daughter is there. I know in my own family, my own relatives, right here in Israel, they called the bitzads, the swamp, you understand? It's a new Hebrew word for katamon. Srugim, the TV series. Have you seen it? Do you live it? You know what goes on? It's unbelievable. Boys and girls and boys. And I see it every Friday night and every Shabbos. They're walking back and forth and they're bringing food here and bringing food there. Ribbono shel Olam. If I had my way, I would take the boy and girl, shove them together. You get it. I'm being Masada Kedushin for you 1 month from now. Get ready? That's it. Masada Kedushin 2 months from now. No, Kasha could create Yamsef. They'll wind up throwing me into the sea, like what happened to Paro v'Chelav. But then they needed Shabbos, and he was the head. This was a tremendous innovation that saved many, many, many Jews. And it's unbelievable, but this was the reality. You know Chabad? So let me tell you a little story that you read about, but I don't have to read it because my wife's cousin was there at the pier. When the sixth Rebbe came, they publicized in all the papers, Chabad Nent, whoever holds Chabad close, the sixth Rebbe is coming to live in America. It's 1940. And come to the pier to greet him. So about 3,000-4,000 Jews came down to the pier, Battery Park, and the Rebbe was in a wheelchair. There's movies of this, pictures, and my cousin told us, and I read about it. So when the Rebbe appeared, they started a Chabad Nigun. And Jews were singing and crying. And people walked away, and they said, we can't be Mechalov Shabbos more. The Rebbe's in America. They were totally, for many of them it was a struggle. They were not Mechalov Shabbos again. The women was not so easy. Generally you would think the women are more than the men, but seeing in Chassidus, the men have a deeper connection. Because you have a Fabrengen, you go, I Shabbos in my shul, Chabad has their own separate minyan at 9:30, 10 o'clock. My colleagues in New York would put them in Chayrim, but I'm, what can I do? I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I took the Rav totally, not partially. So then, after davening, Zay Fabrengen. I come back for Mincha, there in the middle with Kugel and vodka. And they're, pardon me for breaking into Yiddish, but I'm, they're speaking Hebrew, but I'm living it in Yiddish. And they say, tell him from the Rebbe, like a Shichter, I see their faces. Then I read in Dolphin's new book, this is Chabad, not like Satma. Satma Davins makes Kiddush, goes home. Chabadnik almost doesn't see the mother and the wife and the children on Shabbos. Till Bizei Fabregen, till they daven Mincha. So the women don't have that deep attachment. The men have deep, although you can't generalize today. In Chabad, the Rebbetzins are unbelievable. So I have a good word. I'll add the Rakefet twist to this. You know when the women became from? When their kids came home from yeshiva. Now Chabad opens, Tomchei Tamimim, they're more yeshiva in New York. A kid comes home and says, Mama, the father said to her, you're embarrassing me. She goes to the beauty parlor every Saturday. She had a 10 o'clock appointment since 1929. And since Saturday night, they go to the movies. Remember what was built in New York? The palace, the movies. There was no TV, no computer. Who goes to a movie today? Anything I want to see, I see on my computer. So she says to the husband, Beryl, I should give up my beauty parlor appointment? Absolutely. Oh, but 2-3 years later, the kid comes home. Mama, you're embarrassing me. That was the end. Shmirat Shabbos began. What a wife will do for a kid, she doesn't do for a husband. That's the way life works. Kanaim Harim. All right. He gets credit. But no. Now there's something else. And here, you'll see what he writes about in the unfailing light. Fascinating. By the early 1910s, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman is famous. Remember we spoke about last week, he did a doctorate. We spoke about his translation of the 19 letters. I told you I'm only sitting here because of that. Remember, Charlie, I'm only sitting here. I mean, I have to be honest. I told my wife, she agreed with me. I have the right wife. In my life, I had many hard periods. I don't know. You can't start to understand what life was like here after the Yom Kippur War. And we didn't have money for the fourth Shabbos of the month. And it's not an easy thing to say. But it's a reality. I was on the books. The whole economy was black. Today, Baruch Hashem, you can't write a check. It has to be direct to the person. And you have to file if it's over a certain amount, what the check is about, who it is. If I transfer money to my grandchildren, I have to tell them why. I have to answer Mishpacha. Maybe one day they'll come and ask me that, but it's not your name, it's not Rick, it's Ackerman, it's Samuel, it's Eisen, these are my grandchildren, what can I do? I only had daughters, so the name Rakefet is gone. Maybe I'll have a great granddaughter named Rakefet, first name, I'll dance for joy. Okay, Kenzine. But This is the reality. He, Rabbi Bernard Drachman, so come back to the 19 letters, it's very simple. To do what I did in life, I had to have the right wife. So I asked my mother-in-law, born in America, my wife has great-great-grandparents buried in Queens in Mount Hebron. I said to my mother-in-law, born 1906 in Brooklyn, how did you remain from? No one else in the family remained from. So she told me, when she was in high school, she read Bernard Drachman's translation of the 19 letters, Ben Uziel, right? What's it called? And that kept her. She was inspired. She remained 100% Baruch Hashem and imparted it to her children. So he now is very famous. How many do you have in the Western world? Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman, translator of Rav Hirsch, PhD, wrote a sefer, his doctorate on Rishonim. And at this time, the chief rabbi of England, 1912, the incumbent, the very reverend Dr. Herman Adler, passed away. And during the summer of 1912, they invite Rabbi Drachman to come to London to stand for the chief rabbinate of the British Empire. Obviously, Rabbi Drachman was not elected. It was Rabbi Dr. Hertz, also a seminary graduate. He was not didn't have the Orthodox smicha. He was a seminary graduate. Dr. Hertz, the most famous graduate of the seminary at that time. And Rabbi Drachman, in his memoir, tells two stories why he believes he wasn't selected. And these stories shed light on the period, on him, and on the rabbinate. First story, very fascinating, and I have to tell you, that happened to me. I came to this community, let it remain nameless, and a very important, big, wealthy synagogue. Three different rabbis in the shul, the regular rabbi, the assistant rabbi, and the student rabbi. All three were my students. And I know them intimately. And I'm greeted, they whisper in my ear, Rebbe, be very careful, you can't eat in the rabbi's house. His wife. If I would describe these three rabbis, I told Malka, we have a reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi, and an orthodox rabbi. All in absolutely one synagogue. The orthodox one came from a Lakewood family. He's in Toronto today. One of my best students ever. The other one, Baruch Hashem, is in Israel today. You always went with the sheet. If you find one tshuva that's make here, you can pask him that way. And he's taker involved with Soha today. So I'm not entirely wrong when I viewed him in the middle. And the other rabbi, my good Talmud, my good friend, but nevertheless, a spotty personal record, let it not go further. You've read about him in the New York Times many times over. So here he comes to London, and you have to understand, London then was the United Synagogue, totally integrated. Many of the Balabatim were not Shomer Shabbos, but the shul they davened in had to be Orthodox. It was an Ashkenazic concept. You find it in England, you find it in South Africa, you find it in Australia. So today, again, life has changed. Today there's a rebirth of Torah, Baruch Hashem. But you all can understand what I'm saying. It's not like Young Israel, where basically in the Young Israel synagogues, 90% was Shomer Shabbos. So he's invited to this very important dinner of this important synagogue, and all the heads of synagogue, the United Synagogue, are going to be there. That's the organization where you have a chief rabbi, and he even mentions the name, and you see what you wouldn't do today, and he mentions the name of the Reverend A.A., whatever his name is, let it remain in the book, and they whisper in his ear, the meeting is in his house, but the Frum people say, you can't eat there. It's problems with his wife. So now he comes, And there he's sitting at the table with reverends. By the way, in London, in the United Synagogue, the only one called rabbi was the chief rabbi. Everyone else is called the reverend. It was the same thing in the Israeli rabbinate. Under Rav Goren, there was only one rav, and everyone else had less of a title, katzin dat, etc. So the reverend who's hosting the dinner sees he's not eating. And he evidently understood there's gossip behind his back. And he says to him, "What? You don't trust my kashrut?" And poor Rabbi Drachman is caught in the crossfire. You understand? And this left a very bad impression. And he writes that I should have had more experience to allow myself to come into a controversy like this. But he had no choice. He really believed you can't trust them. And I can understand it well. If the wife is not 100%, you have a problem. All right. So that's one little story he tells. The second story is very interesting. Almost all the speeches that Dr. Drachman gave in England were delivered in English. However, on one occasion, he was asked to address a group of immigrants from Eastern Europe in Yiddish. To the astonishment of those who made this request, he replied, quote, "I should not care to use the Yiddish as the language of my servants." They said, "Why not?" He replied, "I do not consider Yiddish a language in the true sense of the term. It is at best a dialect of the German. It is incorrect and ungrammatical German. Since I can speak a correct German, I see no reason why I should myself corrupt and spoil the language I speak." No, I need not tell you that they're not going to elect a person. London is not that far from Poland. It's in Europe. Plenty of East Europeans. Moldach and Dreden Yiddish. It's not the end of the world. But you see, he was a German. Probably his native language was German. Probably his parents spoke German. And to hear the corrupt Yiddish when you know a proper German, it didn't ring well in his ears. And he absolutely refused. Well, you can understand why he remained in Zichron Ephraim. Could be that other factors too. I don't know if his wife was so anxious to go to England after being in America. Until today, the American civilization is higher than English civilization. English people have no difficulty adjusting to the life standard in Israel. When we came in Aliyah, I remember we didn't have enough feed. Everyone's complaining about enough feed. The English never complained. When I finally got to England and spent a month there, I understood why. They don't have heating. It's like Israel, the same system. Not overdone. In America, you can walk into a house during the week, during the winter, and you have to take your sweater off. You just have to walk around in a shirt. Not in England. In England, you need a sweater that can get cold. That's not as cold as New York, but it's a different standard of living. Here in Israel today, it's remarkable. Well, I can talk about 50 years. Charlie, you can talk about, 45 years. It's remarkable what we have seen, and I'm not one, I always say about the Americans, I hope the day will come that they'll have to come in Aliyah, not because of anti-Semitism, not because of this, that, because our standard of living is higher here. Ah, that's an achievement. Baruch Hashem. Now, there's something else, comes back to America, and there's something else about him that everyone who knows about Rabbi Drachman will tell you this. One of his congregants, Harry Houdini, recognized the name. His real name, Erich Weiss, a Yiddish Namen. He was a pupil in the Talmud Torah of Zichron Ephraim. His father, Dr. Meir Weiss, was a from Hungarian-born rabbi, Harav Dr. Meir Weiss. And he had problems. He was not making a living, dire financial state, and Rabbi Rachman wanted to help him. So he came to Rabbi Weiss and said, look, I'll give you some money to tide you over. And Rabbi Weiss said, no, I don't want to take charity. But you know what? Come to my library and pick out some sfarim and buy them from me. And he saw that Rabbi Weiss, has a beautiful set of Maimonides of the Rambam, and he bought that set from him. Fine. Years later, Dr. Weiss died, and Houdini is sitting shiva, and he's now world famous, not a poor man, and Rabbi Drachman goes to him, we're raising funds to pay off the mortgage of the synagogue. Buy it out. And he asked him for a donation in memory of his father. And Houdini says, I will give you $500. Make the cheshbon what we're talking about today. $500, let's say, 100 years ago. Okay? On one condition. It's not a donation to the shul. I'm buying back my father's Rambam that you bought from him. And he says, he sent the set of Rambam back to him in memory of his father within 24 hours of the return of the Sfarim. He received Houdini's check for $500. When Houdini died in 1926, it was Rabbi Drachman who officiated at the funeral. So you see, here you have an American rum, rabbi doctor, integrated, ad kedei kach, that he refused to speak Yiddish, would not give a sermon in Yiddish. The ground is prepared for what's going to happen. Forerunner. Overture. Be interesting. Someone should do a thesis comparing the big three to Rabbi Drachman, where they were similar, where they differed. I can assure you that Rabbi Lichtenstein, if he had to, would probably give a drasha in Yiddish to attract some East European multimillionaires who appreciated a rabbi in Yiddish. I'm not certain. Rabbi Young, I don't know what his facility was in Yiddish. He was raised German, English. I don't know. It'd be interesting. If anyone listening could tell us, the rabbi who was just here last week, Yonatan, if you can tell us, you grew up in Jewish Center, what was Rabbi Young's command of Yiddish? Rabbi Goldstein? I imagine he had to have Yiddish. He grew up in New York City, the East Side. He has smicha from Rabbi Shalom Yaffe in addition to JTS. So I imagine he too had a command of Yiddish. But you see, Rabbi Drachman, look at that, a principle. I will not speak a corrupt language. All right? Let it be. I can only tell you that in Vilna, 1989, first public talk in the one surviving synagogue. Communism was starting to fall, and here I am in Vilna, and their flags up of independent Lithuania. When I showed those pictures to the Russians who were here already, they said they can't believe if you would have put up a flag of independent Lithuania in 1960s, 70s, or early 80s, mid-80s, you would be sent to Siberia immediately. And here there were flags up and no one interfered. And they changed the names. The communists had changed the names of the streets. And the names now were back to the original names before the communists take over. And I was able to speak in public in the shul. So I had a real problem. I don't speak Russian. The younger generation knew Hebrew. The older generation knew Yiddish. So I spoke Hebrew. Paragraph, same paragraph, Yiddish. Hebrew, Yiddish. So, Baruch Hashem, more or less, everyone understood me. But I do not have that prejudice to Yiddish, maybe because I don't have command of the German language. All I know is that the most precious gift I got as a kid in seventh grade, when my Rebbeim walked in from Shanghai in 1947, 48, 49, 50, 51, they don't speak a word of English, and I don't speak practically not a word of Yiddish. And Baruch Hashem, the rest is history. Now, I'm going to talk about the synagogues. So you have a Rabbi Drachman. Rabbi Drachman was fortunate. He married the right girl. It's like a yeshiva boy today. You look for a girl with a PhD. Papa has dough. Right or wrong? He married the right girl. He married the president's daughter. But you're talking about the big three. Talking about Rabbis Goldstein, Young, Lichtenstein. They're fabulous individuals. But you need shuls that will be appreciative of them. And I want to talk about the development of these shuls. And I want to call your attention to a fabulous volume. And again, I ask for guidance. Did this lady go to Ramaz? I mean, this volume, I think it's her doctorate. I tried. She's not on Wikipedia. So what I could come up with, her name is Jenna Weissman Joslett. Anyone recognize the name? She's published quite a few books. Jenna Weissman Joslett. And she's at George Washington University, Washington, D.C. And very highly thought of academically. This is the book I'm quoting from, New York's Jewish Jews. The Orthodox community in the interwar years, the interbellum years, between World War I to World War II. And I have to say, a wonderful volume. I'm not just saying it because she quotes me in my scholarship, but I'm saying it because I feel this cannot be written by an outsider. She's not an outsider looking in. Sometimes you have books written about the Jews that non-observant Jews wrote or non-Jews wrote. Here I get the feeling it's an insider looking out. Now, someone told me she went to Ramaz, which would of course indicate where she comes from and her home and where she sat in life, and it would solve the puzzle for me. If anyone knows, let me know. Okay, this is the book, and this is exactly the period we're talking about. The new type of modern or Americanized, westernized orthodoxy. There's no question, if someone's going to ask you, when does it begin? After World War I. And it's exactly when the seminary, Solomon Schechter dies in 1917, and this is exactly when Mordechai Kaplan becomes the dominant personality at the seminary. And this is exactly when Mordechai Kaplan reveals his inner thinking for the first time in public. I think his first article where he denies Matan Torah and the whole concept of revelation was first published in 1919. So that this book literally covers the period when it gives birth to this nascent American orthodoxy. Now, I'm quoted in the chapter, it's chapter 2.
That was
excuse me?
No, that was the special. They said they used the Sabbath observing Jews before they used the term Orthodox.
All right, very nice, very nice. Bigger and better Orthodox synagogues. And here, the description is fabulous. The Jews on the east side who made it, they moved uptown. All of you who have toured the east side, the tenement tours, and all of you, I still have recollections visiting my aunts and uncles, or my great aunts and uncles on the east side. Remember I told you I still recall how the bathroom was not in the apartment. It was shocking to me as a kid. And I told you, my mother said that my mother lived 98 years as a Chrono Levracha. So my mother always said the greatest improvement she saw in her life was that you had sanitary conditions in the apartment. I mean, think for a minute what we take for granted. In Russia, you could still see it probably today as well. Under the communists, tourists were only allowed to travel in about 10% of Russia. You were limited. The in-tourists took you. 90% of Russia they weren't allowed to show you. And you wondered why. And the answer was very simple. The poverty was so great, they didn't want the world to know what Russia's really about. It was a Potemkin's village. So the East Side, then they made it. Those who made it, the Upper East Side, wow. And some of them remained from, and they wanted a proper shul to daven in. And in 1902, they laid the cornerstone of what is Kehilat Jeshurun, part of Ramaz today. Those of you who know what I'm talking about, Lexington Avenue, I believe it's 85th Street. And the description, a clear, warm day, beautiful skies, an excellent band, sweet-throated choristers, and elegant speakers greeted the vast concourse of Jewish citizens and their elegantly attired dames. Now you see from this description, you have made it a corner-laying ceremony, cornerstone. People dressed magnificently. Elegant dames. Remember, one concept of you'll meet the old-time Israelis, you'll talk with some of the women. They'll say, it's a crazy world today. I've heard this more than once. I had 3-4 dresses. That was it. I go to my daughter's closet today. There are more dresses than I had in a lifetime. You've heard this. Right? A man, all right, we men can wear the same thing. It's not the end of the world. When you're in the world that you wear a uniform, you know my Shaila, a kid in Bells, how does he dress differently for Shabbos? So my vote is, it's based on the Rambam, that he doesn't have a pen in his pocket. You follow me? My difference is, I put on a white shirt. I once wore a white shirt during the weekend. A grandson, a little kid at the time, he's a big kid today with 4 children, but he said to me, Sabu, it's not Shabbat today. Why are you wearing a white shirt? So I was proud. The kid understood a white shirt indicates Shabbat. But a woman, oh boy, you have a wedding. You know what a wedding means to a woman? I know one woman was cursing Israel, and I don't blame her. Her daughter was getting married, and she went to America, and she came back with 10 different dresses for her daughter, her daughters, the grandchildren. It was a granddaughter getting married. And they stopped her at customs. They accused her that she's going to sell the dresses. Go and explain to this primitive guy at customs that this is Minig America, that every woman has to have a new dress for a wedding. I have a wedding coming up. My wife got a thing, the buttons and this, that kind of going on. Punish your wife. My daughters, the Toferet in Givat Mordechai, right across the street, Kanain Hara, and the Ktuva. I got to tell you, my wife doesn't want to make a pup. She wants the copywriter. The first 3D ketuvah ever. And I don't think my granddaughter even can appreciate. She's an Israeli, right? Ketuvah. Oh, man, this is a museum piece. This is the dedication of what becomes Ramaz, Kehilat Jeshurun. Ah, but this is nothing. All the Jewish papers are boasting who attended the dedication. Vic, you're sitting?
Yes.
Jacob Schiff. Got it? Jacob Schiff. You understand? You can't. This is like bringing in, I don't know how to describe it. You're bringing into this class Mayor Bloomberg, and Raketvit is pleading with him, give $1 billion to Yeshiva University. All right. On my conditions, don't misunderstand me. I don't let it go. I have plans for Yeshiva Halevai. They should listen to me. Tomchei Tamimim, another morning program, a mikvah, do what I bring in the Hasidim. They're alive and kicking, Neo Hasidus. We've lost the battle. We can't fight the Gomes battle. Some of them are the Dobbin 10:30 Shabbos morning. All right, I'll smack their face. But I can't dismiss all of Chassidus because of these Chabadnikim, Ufabrenga, Gamsa Targzum, Zangizum. That's, we've lost. Vic, we got to live with it. Jacob Schiff. Wow. And they described, listen to this, one of the most pleasing features of the ceremony, an intimation that Schiff had by his presence placed his own considerable imprimatur on the activities of New York's Orthodox. And he was one of those who laid the cornerstone with the shovel. He was on it. I'm sure that he gave a handsome donation. But you see what's happening. 85th Street between Park and Lexington Avenue, undoubtedly one of the finest edifices ever erected by an Orthodox synagogue in the United States. This is what the papers, newspapers are writing. And what a difference of the shul. Beautiful, big, large plans for a woman's balcony with dignity. And right in the heart of the most expensive neighborhood that you can imagine. Now, start to think. Compare Kehilat Yeshurun to the shtibbles on the Lower East Side. What does a shtibble look like? Go through Yerushalayim. Go through Katamon. On every block there's a shul. How big are they? Take the shul that built Katamon, that changed the world, that made Jack into a millionaire, that made me, and no, me too, I'm also. Know what I'm talking about? When I came in Aliyah, you know what Katamon was? Eidot HaMizrach, Svadim, primitives, nothing with nothing. You could buy for $10,000. That building that you bought for $10,000 today is $1,100,000. Right or wrong, Jack? And what one, why you Musmachani wrote, built the Shtiblach. Shtiblach, in my time, Shabbos morning, there were two minyanim. The first minyan had like 12, 13 people. The second minyan had 20, 30. You know what goes on in the Shtiblach today? In Katamon. My grandchildren move away. They cry. They don't miss their mother, don't miss their father, don't miss any. The Shtiblach! Oh, we didn't know how lucky we were. I told them when I grew up, you planned your life around davening. No, you grow up in Katamon, you plan your davening around life. Whenever you want, Jack, whenever Jack wants, he falls out of his bed, rolls down one hill, walks up half a block, has a meeting, 7:24. Right or wrong?
A few hours in the afternoon.
In the afternoon, and it's after midnight. It's not like you're not yet like the Zichron Moshe. Zichron Moshe, you can catch Marv at 4 o'clock in the morning. You can daven Marv, and then 2 minutes later, put on tefillin and daven Shacharis. That's Zichron Moshe, don't... You're not yet there. But we'll be there, Bezrat Hashem. No, you come to the Shtiblach. The rooms, no space. We get people come to my son-in-law, Shua, he's president, half a block away from the Shtiblach. I said, why are you davening here suddenly? I want to be able to sit when I daven. I want to be able to put a sitter down and you know, b'menucha panefesh. The Shtiblach, four rooms. They daven on the outside this side. They daven on the other side. You got to be young. You got to be able to stand. Who can get a chair on the outside? What are we talking about? They put up a curtain on the outside. Women stand behind the curtain. Unbelievable. Kila Jeshurun. What a building. What a difference. What a sight. One of the rabbis declared, it's the Pereira Mendes, the solar pool, that element, refined surroundings for divine worship. And Rabbi David, the solar pool, then in his prime, coming into his prime, and you have to understand who we're talking about. He was married to Rabbi Hirschhorn's daughter. He was married to a girl born in Jerusalem. Her father was a big Talmud Chacham. He left Jerusalem, was in Jersey City. A woman we've spoken about, there were three daughters. Each one became a Shem Dava. Two remained Frum. The other one, Tehila, the founder with her husband of Jewish scientist, or whatever they call it. It's not reform exactly, but it's humanism, a different type of approach to God, to Torah, to life. Jewish science, it's called. We spoke about it in class, but the Solopul's wife, Tamar, she published on the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue Portraits Etched in Stone. Do you remember that book? She was Ashkenaziyah, but did give dignity of the Sephardic community. The other sister was Nina Adlerblum, who was a great mind, that a student of John Dewey, Professor Dewey. They were very, very unique people. And he describes what a change. Instead of the undignified and unsightly little Chevra immigrant synagogue, a little synagogue that presented, quote, a most dour appearance. And finally, let me end off the class, and this brings me back. Sitting before Rabbi Lichtenstein, I had the privilege of studying with all the big three rabbis. Goldstein, Young, and Lichtenstein were all my teachers. You're all sitting? Tell me. And I still remember this from the Bronx. Come into a shul. Fine. Benches. Tables. One other aspect to the shul. Forget about the Aron Kodesh. Bookcases. Spittoons. Do you remember that or not?
No.
God's a love pit, and I still remember it from the brother. They go back and say, ah, no? Do you know that these spittoons carried over even in Kilat Jeshurun originally? There were spittoons. And Rabbi Lichtenstein said, the hardest fight I had in my rabbinate. And we all jump forward, Rabbi Lichtenstein. Learning with Joseph Lichtenstein, the hardest fight I had to get them to get rid of the spittoons. And he said, people who were multi-millionaires said to him, my father's shul had a spittoon. My grandfather's shul had a spittoon. Why can't we have a spittoon in KJ? And here she writes about it, that what was common in spittoons, unsanitary synagogues, a poorly ventilated woman's precinct with a capacity of 15, but accommodating 41 necessary. And one eyewitness glumly reported, a subway rush hour spirit prevailed. You know what that is, the rush hour. Where I davened this morning. One time a Talmud of mine out of the 60s wanders into the shul. There's a lot of tourists know Armenian because in our neighbor they're catching a flight back to America. They want to daven early. So he says, Rebbe, you daven with such kavana, you know. I look at him, I said, I'm davening normal. But compared to everyone else, I look like I have kavana. I have yet to say kedusha in the morning davening where I daven. So, Ellie, you'll ask me, why do I daven there? I'm davening there so many decades. We're interlocked with the people davening there, you understand? But you talk about a subway rush hour? You go in a shtibble, even in Katamon. Depends where you daven. Ani Shul davens, they daven slowly, properly. Little, but then you have the wise Alec Americans who go outside, they'll shoot the chassan if he's not quick enough. Herbie Maltz tries things I need covered, you know, I'm so distant. It's totally out of my concepts. The first rabbinate beat the hell out of me and that's it. But he once wanted them to wait for me when I would be done, because my grandchildren would done, I'd be done there, go out of my way there. Yeah, outside. So I told Herbie, it's Tikra de Tzibura. Do you understand what you're doing? Forget about it. No, I want them to appreciate who you... Herbie, please. Rush hour.
If Arya Stern, they wait.
And then I'll go on and on. These are people speaking. This type of attitude, primitive, untutored, undignified, and un-American, underline those words. And then, Kehilat Yeshurun, just think of the seats. When's the last time you were there? Velvet on the seats. You sit down. You don't feel the bench. You don't feel the seat. You don't feel the wood. You're on a velvet cushion built into every seat. And the rabbi speaking at the dedication, the Balabatam speaking, quote, Orthodoxy does not stand for the milieu of East Broadway. Can you repeat that, Yomo? Orthodoxy does not stand for the milieu of East Broadway. This is Kehilat Yeshurun. And I'll take it to modern terminology. I'll show it to you very simply. You want to see the difference. A Talmud just wrote to me from, I read it yesterday in class, his complaints about the talking in shul. So I wrote back to him, I said, look, there are other problems, not just the problem that I spoke about yesterday in class. I wrote back to him, you cannot daven in Borough Park. It is impossible. And the reason is very simple. People are schnurring for money. You can be in the middle of Kriyat Shema, and someone is looking down at you, eye contact, tapping you on the shoulder. No, can you picture in Kehilat Yeshurun a schnur is going to come around in the middle of davening? Don't throw him out head first. You understand? There's a whole different milieu developing. Now, it doesn't happen overnight. We have to be honest. The spittoons, Rabbi Luchstein claimed it took him years to get rid of the spittoons. I don't know if it's ever been documented. What year did they actually stop gurgling and spitting? And God have mercy, but a shul is a shul. But the fact that Jacob Schiff was there, you can see the new wind. It is shifting gears. He is proud. He is happy. This is an, what was the term he used? An Americanized orthodoxy. An enlightened orthodoxy. See, Jacob Schiff plays a big role. It hurts the heart. I mean, what remains of him when you play games with Yiddishkeit? Nothing ultimately remains. There's one other fact I got from the article on Jacob Schiff. Schiff's descendant, Andrew Newman Schiff, was married to former Vice President Al Gore's daughter, Karina. So you see that Schiff, take a look, right? Take a look, Clinton's daughter, who she married to. But was blight from Yiddishkeit. You remember Clinton's daughter's wedding? The guy wore a talis on Shabbos, a mugging dovet. He didn't know what to do. Chilul Shabbos b'parchesia, a treif dinner, but the simanim, Clinton's family, daughter, and the marriage has survived. Unbelievable. Take a look where you are today, where President Trump has something that 3 million American Jews do not have. He has Shemesh Shabbos grandchildren. Am I right or wrong? Yaakov, what do you say? Right, think for 4 million American Jews don't have. He has more than anyone else. Shomer Shabbos grandchildren. But wow. See, it's a process beginning 100 years ago. It's a new shul, a new concept, a new outlet. Doesn't happen overnight. But Jacob Schiff, groundbreaking ceremony at Kehillat Jeshurun. I wonder if I walked into Ramaz and asked the class, who was Jacob Schiff? How many would know? You follow, Vic? This is living history, but it's life moves on. You have to accept it. You remember last week I asked, who knows who Yosef HaTzadik Mendelovich is? Remember? And these kids looked at me. Unbelievable. And I have to be honest, when Washington came out, I thought for sure there'll be some remnant in Maplewood, New Jersey that will contact me. I built that shul from the ground. Yesh Mayayim. All right, I left 50 years ago. I arrived there almost 60 years ago. No one even knows my name. The people I dealt with are gone, a new generation. Who cares about the past? This is part of America, part of the Western world.
Does the shul still exist?
The shul, there's a Chabad Rav there, Rav Bogomilsky. Does the shul still exist? The shul is now a dormitory or something. I don't know, some yeshiva there. They took over the church up the block. That was the church. I always had a fight with my wife. As we would drive down, coming home, we had it turn left at the church, go a block and a half, and there was our house, 40 Suffolk Avenue. I lived there several very formative years in my life, 47 years, 70, 62 to 69. And my wife would say, oh, there's the church, we got to turn. I say, don't mention the church, you're not allowed. Follow me where you are today. What's the problem? The church is the shoe. They took off the steer. It's unbelievable. We came back, we couldn't believe. Leave it there. We walked in. So you have the RCA sitter of Art Scroll and Chabad Siddurim with English. The people have a choice. What are you talking about? But that's life. Life moves on. But Jacob Schiff was a figure, a role model, amazing. All right, and I'll end off with the story I've told you many times about Jacob Schiff. It was an only killer Jeshurun. One time, and this day, right, this is written up in his biography. So one time on the Lower East Side and on Norfolk Street, the Beis Medrash HaGadol, I think it was called, big shul. And they come shop to Daven Wednesday morning, and a carriage, like a Cadillac, is parked outside. A carriage with horses, a horseman, and a whatever, outside the shul. They come into the shul. There's Jacob Schiff, davening, tallis, tefillin. After davening, they say, Mr. Schiff, how are we honored by your presence, the president of Temple Emmanuel? He said, have you outside for my mother today? Do you think I can hold that yard sign in Temple Emmanuel? Absolutely not. I have to hold it where she'll be happy, where she'll be pleased. So you see, this is the Mecca. Okay, we have a lot more to do, as you can understand, but you're getting a feeling, and I love the volume. She is fabulous. I mean, she's from the inside looking out. She understands. I mean, who can understand the spittoon in Kehillat Jeshurun? All right, I have the advantage because I heard Little Joe and Claire. Oh, they were fabulous teachers. Rabbi Goldstein, I would come to him. I mean, and you'll see here, he's being criticized for what he boasted about to us. You'll see. And I'm just sad that Rabbi Rubin isn't here because he remembers these people as well. Rabbi Young, Rachmanut. You understand how to me to say it the original way. But these were people. But they changed the New York scene. Today it's a different story, but they were unique in their time. And you'll see, when I called them the Big Three, I didn't make it up. I'm quoting my Rebbe, the Rav. I'll give you the source. The Big Three, like Gerrick, Ruth, and Lazari. You follow? You guys don't even know what I'm talking about. It was Murder Israel in the 30s. You want to know more, Charlie? I have a student, what's his name? I'm blocking out. It was Masada Kedushin when he got married in Yehuda, what's his last name? Anyone can help me? Yehuda, he was in the second year of BMT. It's before your time. Anyway, his father had a pharmacy around the corner from Yankee Stadium. Singer, Yudah Singer, thank you, Yudah Singer, of course. Yehuda Singer. Brother Eugene, we called him. Eugene in English, Yehuda in Hebrew. Hanukkah, Purim, they put on a skit, two guys, he and Chariton. They, most Charitons, they were Brother Eugene and Brother Morris. It's like yesterday, it has to be 1970, 71. So his father had a pharmacy around the corner on Jerome Avenue from Yankee Stadium. Now, in those days, there were only day games in the 30s into the 40s, right? Only day games. So after the game, they all go get drunk. It's not like today where the players are making tens of million dollars of the year. They're more careful with their bodies. Then now they're drunk. They have to go home. It's 9, 10 o'clock at night. So they would come into the pharmacy to get a drink he would give them that would enable them to be more sober. I don't know, maybe there's a pharmacist there. Herbie Maltz could probably tell us what they would use. Their wives used to call him Mr. Singer. That's Brother Eugene's father. Has Tony come in yet? Tony Lazzari. Follow me? The babe couldn't care less, but Tony Lazzari's wife did it. Lou Gehrig never drank. See, he was a gentleman. Mother, you know the story. Mother, he got married late. Rivalry between his wife and mother, he had fascinating. And these were the Gedolim Sheba Aretz that we grew up on, and you can't get it out of your blood. Did you grow up with baseball, Charlie, in Washington?
Mickey Mantle.
Mickey, so you're the next generation. My original students all worship Mickey Mantle. The ground that maneuver walked on. You follow? See, let's not get started. DiMaggio, you have to give credit that he was a chatzi maneuver. If you know the inside stories. So when Clinton commanded it with that Jewish woman in the White House, DiMaggio was furious. With my tax money in the White House, you follow? He was a bum, DiMaggio, but within limits, you see. He was an Italian, a Catholic. He occasionally went to Mass. He couldn't go. He once walked into St. Patrick's Cathedral. I can show you the sources. And they went crazy. Everyone recognized him. He couldn't appear in public. He couldn't even go to Mass. And when the Archbishop or the Cardinal got up to give the sermon, the homily, he had to mention DiMaggio's day. He was embarrassed. The man wanted to talk to God, not to talk to 100 other people and the Cardinal of New York. My dear students, what can I tell you? My upbringing reflects, but we are who we are. And above all, Torah has to win out. What did we do today? First of all, I want to welcome everyone. Baruch Hashem. It's a pleasure to see everyone. I want to thank you for coming. And I want to thank all those listening across the wide expanse. We shifted gears from Rabbi Drachman. The stories of England are fascinating. What do you do when you come into a house and you're told you can't trust the rabbi's kashrut? Remember what I told you yesterday with Lieutenant Birnbaum? When Rojo, his Indian non-Jewish Shabbos guy, sees that everything that reaches Lieutenant Birnbaum is kosher, and they meet the Kloisenberger Rebbe after the death camps are liberated, and the Rebbe gives Lieutenant Birnbaum food, whatever it was, and Rojo is worried it's not kosher. And Lieutenant Birnbaum has to assure him you can trust the Kloisenberger Rebbe. No, what do you do when you come in and I'm told don't eat in the rabbi's house, etc.? It's a real problem. The Yiddish is fascinating. If I'd be Bernard Drachman, I would have given a shiur in Yiddish. Don't make an issue out of it. But it could be, because he was a native German speaker, it troubled him. Then we shifted gears and we're into, hold on one second, the new book that I introduced. It's not a new book, but for you, it's probably new, and it's a wonderful volume, and she's setting the stage for the new type of Orthodox synagogue. We have a lot more to do. Next week, we'll go into it in much more depth, but we ended off with the dedication, cornerstone laying of KJ. Yes?
You didn't say what you did when they told you not to eat in the rabbi's house.
Fortunately, I never had a problem, because the meals were public events. So I was eating, it was a fabrengen, you understand, the hitvadut in modern Hebrew, a fabrengen in mamalashen, and I was eating in public, catered kosher catering, glatt kosher catering, But it could be a terrible problem. You don't embarrass the rabbi. What do you do? I've had Chabadnikim. There was a Chabad family that we knew from Russia. And Mois and Nefesh, they get out, and we made a Kabbalah's Panim for them in my house, and they wouldn't eat. And they tell me, Chabadnikim don't eat in anyone's house. I don't know how smart that is. We punish Lelim. I would trust someone in Yudusha. The Rav Leizer Silver didn't eat in anyone's house. You know, the sandwiches. Whose house did he eat in? In the Brisker Rav's house. That house he ate in. I can tell you more, but I have to turn off the tape recorders. We'll do it in a second. Okay. Next Sunday, I pick up where I left off. And it's a special Sunday. The second Shiv of the Malamed Lahoil. The Napoleon Sanhedrin. And I hope we'll start the Rav. And next week, I pick up exactly where I left off here. Just to make I'll give out the freebies in a minute, just to make the tape complete. Besara Tova Yeshut Venechamot, Das Vedanya. Okay? Let me just turn off.